Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, ecumenism at the top of the agenda. We find out about the theme for this week of prayer for Christian unity, as well as hearing about some important upcoming ecumenical events. And a return to the Holy Land. Following my recent visit to Israel and Palestine with the coordination group, we hear from a South African priest taking part in the pilgrimage for the first time this year. The turbulent lessons of Poland's troubled history, the forthcoming European Football Championships, and the teachings of St. Paul all feature in the theme for this year's Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. The annual observance is celebrated between January the 18th and 25th here in the Northern Hemisphere, while it's usually marked at Pentecost by the churches of the Southern Hemisphere. Each year, different churches of a particular region are asked to prepare guidelines on a biblical theme that can form the basis for dialogue and worship throughout this week. For 2012, the churches in Poland have drawn up a text focused on the theme from St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. We will all be changed by the victory of our Lord Jesus Christ. To find out more, I spoke with the Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, Bishop Brian Farrell.
Well, the theme is very fundamental. All of life is a struggle to reach not only our ultimate goal, but as we go through life, we have to struggle to achieve all the good goals that we set ourselves. Well, the term victory stands for that effort and the success that we may have in it. Of course, as Christians, we understand that victory in its full sense can only come from the redemptive grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. And therefore, the ecumenical group of Christians that gathered in Poland to prepare the texts for this year decided that the idea of victory, which comes almost, you might say, naturally out of their history, which has been a history of ups and downs, conflicts and struggles, is very opportune when we think about the great efforts that are being made to bring about the restoration of unity among all Christians. So this concept then they saw in the text of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where St. Paul talks about the ultimate victory, which is when we will reach our ultimate final goal of fullness in God.
Certainly the churches in Poland are looking back at their historical difficulties. They're also, I notice, looking at the this year Poland and Ukraine are hosting the European Football Championship, something which was perhaps unthinkable a few years back with the rivalry between Poland and Ukraine. And of course, this is interesting if we think of St. Paul and his use of the sporting imagery.
Well, I can't say much about the present-day football championships, but the whole idea, as St. Paul says, is that life is like the effort of the runner in the stadium, and he runs to reach the goal. So certainly when they refer to the football championships as a kind of similar model to life and to the spiritual struggles that will eventually bring us our true happiness, I think they've pointed to something that people can understand.
A focus on victory, but there's also a focus on defeat, what defeat means and how we can use this for a positive outcome.
Yes, and the group did make specific reference to the fact that their history, Polish history, is also a history of defeats which caused great suffering and led to the need of the people to go back into themselves and to find the roots of their perseverance. They had to live on in the midst of these defeats. And I think here, too, we could say that division among Christians is a defeat. It's the result of sin. It's the result of pride and historical events in which people perhaps did not act with all the love that the gospel would require. But out of our weakness, out of our need, perhaps we will have the energy to work harder for the restoration of that unity.
Let's look specifically at the dialogue with the Orthodox world, where you're focusing very much on the divisions, but also how to restore a vision perhaps of the first millennium, particularly focusing on the question of the primacy. Can you tell us about the current state of that dialogue, what your hopes are for the coming months?
Well, very briefly, I mean, we are very close to the Orthodox theologically. We have the same faith, we have the same apostolic succession, the priesthood, the episcopacy, so that the difference, the theological difference between us is almost totally concentrated on this one question of structure, authority, the exercise of primacy in the church. In the dialogue, we have reached a point where we all accept, Orthodox and Catholics, that there is a primacy, that in the historical development of the church, this primacy belongs to the Bishop of Rome, but we do not agree on how it is to be exercised. We have been divided for 1,000 years, and in those 1,000 years, we have developed two different ways of exercising the teaching authority, the governance in the church, and naturally it will take much effort, much reflection, and a great deal of humble mutual acceptance to be able to overcome the differences. But I would say that very often the differences are apparently insuperable, but when we look at them very closely, we begin to see how they are there. They are real, but they are not perhaps as big and impossible to overcome as they might seem.
Can we look to any particular events in this coming year that could perhaps help us move forward in this area?
Well, I think that we will continue to have very close and friendly relations with the Orthodox churches. One of the things that's on the horizon is the celebration of the anniversary of the Edict of Milan, which changed the course of the history of the church from a church of persecution to a church in freedom to expand. And then, of course, history tells us how deeply that expansion modeled the life of Europe and the European countries and of the Middle East. So this will be an important occasion. Catholics and Orthodox have slightly different view of Constantine. We thank him for the political freedom he gave. They also consider him to have been a great figure with a saintly characteristic, because he was the instrument of God in a sense, creating the eastern part of the empire and therefore also the Eastern Church.
And there are going to be celebrations, aren't there,
Yes.
In Serbia,
yes.
his birthplace, I believe, for this anniversary.
I would say that there will be celebrations in many countries, in particular, yes, in Serbia, where he was born. And we're looking forward to be able to take part in all of these together, Catholics and Orthodox.
There are hopes that it could be the occasion for a possible meeting between the Pope and the Patriarch from Moscow. Is there any, do you think, hopes that this could be achieved?
Well, I don't think that we should put make this a definite objective of the celebrations. I am not sure that we will be ready. As you know, the preparation of such a meeting is extremely difficult, and it depends not just on the goodwill, but also on how effective we can really be in overcoming some of the tensions that still exist in different parts between Catholics and Orthodox.
Let's look also to the Protestant world, the Protestant and Reformed worlds, and perhaps some of the highlights that you're looking forward to over the coming year.
Well, I think that while there are many difficulties, and almost you might say that it looks like we have new difficulties coming up all the time, because questions about life issues, ethical questions, and so forth, appear to bring more distance between us. But at the same time, my experience of dialogue with the various Protestant communities is that in the face of the huge secularization that is taking place in our Western society, we realize more and more that we have to give common witness, we have to work together, we have to stand together on the issues on which we have a common ground, the basic issues of our faith in God and in God's providence over life. We have to stand together in all of the social service and commitment to the human rights, to the question of poverty in the world, which we must never forget. The reasons that push us to work together are very strong, or the forces that push us together are very strong. And I think that in that sense, we have an opportunity.
Do you think the Synod for New Evangelization this coming October may perhaps be another opportunity to further develop this common mission, this common witness?
Well, I do hope so. And the fact is that we have already begun to work to bring representatives of the various churches to the Synod so that the discussion will be open also to the ecumenical aspect. Naturally, a new evangelization, especially of Europe and America, cannot be done by the Catholic Church alone. We are all part of this reality, and we all have a gift to offer to the new evangelization. I think there is great interest on the part of our ecumenical partners to be involved in this new evangelization.
Which brings us on, in a way, to the third area, perhaps we can call it that, that you work on here at the Council, the area of dialogue with the new Pentecostal movements. What can you tell us about this very, very new and quite exciting dialogue, in a way, isn't it?
Well, it has been going with certain parts of the Pentecostal charismatic world for quite a number of years. But I would say that in the last few years, let's say in the last 5-8 years, there has been a quickening of interest and a new presence of many Pentecostal and charismatic leaders in the ecumenical movement. And so we have developed a number of different conversations with some of these leaders. I think that we also, in the Catholic Church, we have recognized that the charismatic movement has a message that can be of great importance, for example, in the new evangelization. There's an energy, there's a strength, there's a vision that we need to promote and bring to all of our communities. We have to overcome the routine of being just Catholics because we were born that way or because our country is a traditionally Catholic country. We have to have a new vitality. The new evangelization is nothing, it's not that we're inventing some new message or something like that. It's the new energy, the new mode, the new vision, the new courage to go out there and spread the message. And I think that in our dialogue with the Pentecostal and charismatic world, which is growing so fast, we have much to learn, and they too are very open to understanding our experience of the faith and our historical development.
Bishop Brian Farrell there, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity. 2012 also promises to be a year of significant developments for the Catholic Church's relations with the worldwide Anglican Communion. That's according to the official of the Pontifical Council, who follows that dialogue most closely. Monsignor Mark Langham heads the desk for Anglican and Methodist relations. At the beginning of this Christian Unity Week, he talked to me about some important events coming up over the next few months, plus the importance of this week's theme as an introduction to the year's ecumenical calendar.
It's an extremely appropriate theme for us in the Catholic Church this year because the Holy Father has so underlined the importance of our faith in providing that new look on the world, our situation, our troubles, how faith can provide us with a way of turning what seems to be frail and weak and not going too well into something that is wonderful and hopeful and glorious. And so with the context of the Year of Faith that he's announced, it's a wonderful way of leading into that through this week of prayer for Christian unity. Of course, we're looking at the Year of Faith especially through the aspect of the new evangelization, which is a very important theme for us all. And it was Blessed Pope John Paul who said, before the unbelieving world and the attacks of the world, all Christians already are united. We face them as one. And our Holy Father has made very clear in Germany, in his messages in Britain, that all Christians have a task of proclaiming the faith to our society, a society that's lost its way, a society that's moved from indifference to hostility, to attacking the Christian faith. And in the face of that, we can only proclaim the gospel together. As St. Paul says, woe to me if I proclaim not the gospel. That's one of the themes of the new evangelization, and it's a very appropriate theme for all Christians to reflect upon together during this week of prayer for Christian unity.
So in a sense, we're already looking ahead to the Synod coming up this October, an important moment in the ecumenical calendar, in fact, for this year.
Yes, it's wonderful how in the plan of things, the Holy Father's announcements all lead into each other, and so we're looking forward later this year to the Synod of Bishops, which will be upon the new evangelization and has a particularly ecumenical aspect because the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, has been invited out to speak at some length and lead a discussion during that synod. This is again underlining the Holy Father's message that as Christians, we face a world together. We've got to do this task together as Christians.
That'll clearly be one of the highlights then for 2012. Can we look perhaps at other important events coming up specifically regarding your area of influence, your area of expertise, the relations between the Anglicans and the Catholic Church?
Two things that immediately spring to mind. In March, the 1,000th anniversary of the Order of the Camaldolese means that the Archbishop of Canterbury again will be visiting Rome because their headquarters is San Gregorio Magno, which is a very significant church for the worldwide Anglican communion. It was from there, of course, that Pope St. Gregory sent St. Augustine of Canterbury to England to revive the Catholic faith there. And from his line of succession as Archbishop of Canterbury's, that there's a very important aspect of Anglicanism, and the present Archbishop of Canterbury will be there to give witness to that. Perhaps even more wide-ranging and important will be slightly later in May, when we have the second session of the latest round of ARCIC Dialogue. ARCIC is the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission. The commission that was set up by Pope John the 23rd and the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay, so many years ago, and is now in its third stage. And that will be looking at very important questions for both communions, but particularly for the Anglican communion at this time, how to relate the particular to the universal, a question which has bearing on many of the issues that are arising inside the Anglican Communion at the moment. We've a very good team, and the co-chairs are very positive about this dialogue, and so I'm looking forward to that greatly.
You'll be meeting in Hong Kong, I believe, won't you, for that meeting in May. Are we likely to expect any kind of resolution statements, any kind of concrete, tangible results from that this time around?
Well, what we do, Philippa, is that we issue each year, after each meeting, a press statement, but know that the tangible results come at the end of the session, and we don't know how long the session will be. We don't think it'll be as long as ARCIC 2, which was 20 years. We're looking at something perhaps around 5 or 6 years, and at the end of that there will be some form of agreed statement offered to both the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Communion for their assessment.
Looking at a different aspect of a different question, but we have the Ordinariate from England marking its first anniversary this month, don't we? And making a pilgrimage to Rome, I believe.
That's right. They're coming out particularly as an act of thanksgiving for their first very fruitful year of existence. And the head of the English Ordinariate, we now have to make that distinction because there's an American Ordinariate, the head of the English Ordinariate, Monsignor Keith Newton, is leading members of the Ordinariate to give thanks for the many blessings that they have received, but also, I feel it's important to say that they have bestowed on the rest of the church as well. I know Monsignor Newton very well and have kept in touch with him. But, of course, our office formally does not have dealings with the Ordinariate because ecumenism and the Ordinariate are separate issues, though, of course, they're interrelated and have a bearing upon each other.
You're also head of the desk that deals with dialogue with the Methodist world there at the Council for Christian Unity. What perhaps can we look forward to over the coming year on that front?
The Methodist dialogue is one of the oldest dialogue with Western churches. Sometimes that gets forgotten, and it's a very warm dialogue. There's been great stability over 40 years. The membership hasn't changed a great deal. And that's made for a great deal of trust and a great deal of openness in sharing our concerns. We had last summer the World Methodist Council meeting in South Africa. That takes place every 5 years. And then the programme is that for the next 4 years, we will meet Roman Catholics and Methodists to produce an agreed statement, which will be presented to the Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council. There we're going to look at, again, some very interesting things. We're going to go back to the statement on justification agreed between the Catholic and Lutheran Church, but associated with by the Methodists, and go a little bit more deeply into that. This is a time in all our dialogues, Philippa, when we're not really looking to dive in to the most difficult problems, but we're more gently and more thoughtfully going back to first principles, re-examining the scriptures, the common tradition, the councils, the fathers of the church, the teachings of the churches, to really reassess where we begin, how much we have in common, and at what part we diverge. And so we're not expecting any sort of groundbreaking statements, but it's important work for laying down foundations and building up trust.
My thanks there to Monsignor Mark Langham of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity. If you're a regular listener to our programmes, you'll probably know that I've just returned from a visit to the Holy Land with the coordination group of European and North American bishops who make an annual pilgrimage to Israel and Palestine in support of the Christian communities there. From the 6th to the 12th of January, we visited Jerusalem, Haifa, Ramallah and Gaza, talking to local people and meeting with religious and political leaders with the aim of finding ways to support peace and development throughout the troubled region. Also taking part in the group for the first time this year was an official from South Africa. Father Peter John Pearson directs the Parliamentary Liaison Office for the Southern African Bishops' Conference, and he told me more about his participation in this year's Holy Land pilgrimage.
Well, I think the obvious link is that there is such a remarkably similar history. The history of suffering, the history of oppression, the history of land deprivation, the history of dignity being destroyed, all of those very institutional elements of oppression, part of the South African reality and part of the reality that Palestinians describe to us. So there is a deep sense of solidarity just based on the horrible, brutal facts of history.
Are you speaking here from the point of view of the Catholic Church, or would you say there is a wide awareness in South Africa of these similarities and the need for support for a peace process here?
Yes, there is a fairly large support base. It was concretized in the commitment to the Palestinian Kairos document. There is an organization called Kairos Palestine South Africa, which is a broad civil society group. It has trade unions in it, has faith community people, it has peace activists, and so, you know, so there is a broader sense than just the church, but we are one in our sense of how do we do in South Africa what others did for us in the dark days of apartheid: offer hope, offer a values discourse, offer solidarity, spread awareness, all those kinds of things that we talk about in the coordinating group of information and advocacy and solidarity. So, yeah, the synergy is quite a strong one.
And yet it must be quite depressing for you, isn't it, to come here and see so many of the same signs without a solution in sight?
Yes, I mean, that's the most obvious kind of thing that hits you in the face. But I also think that we have, to some degree, come out of that quagmire. And so there is a sense of looking at the facts and then saying, well, this isn't always going to be so. When we looked at it in the past in South Africa, we thought nothing would change for another 100 years. It seemed so intransigent, but it did. And so one says, as bleak as it might be, and it is bleak, the situation here, it's a challenge to identify the roots of hope and the roots of struggle and of solidarity, and saying, how can we be creative? What needs to be brought together? What floating parts need to coalesce? And so, yes, it's desperate, but desperation also raises challenges. And I like to think of the challenges, yeah.
Can you identify for us any of those seeds of hope, any ideas, practical ideas, that people outside can do to support the struggle for justice here?
Look, I think we're living in an era where politics seems to be dominated by technocrats. The EU crisis and so forth, people saying, bring the technocrats in. And we're seeing that in varying degrees with many governments, many places of influence. And I think one of the things we can do, and I see people doing it here, is to say, let's listen to the voices of the people below. People know what they want and what they need and what ways are going forward. We were listening today. I mean, there were new ideas coming from people on a panel this morning, which I hadn't heard before. So I think listening to people, listening to those who are thinking on the ground is one very positive sign. To be able to articulate policy on the basis of that, which is what professional advocacy people do. They look at their, say, their ideological or faith commitment, and they say, how does that lean in with the realities that we're hearing, and let's do something about that. So yes, I think there are those practical things. We heard over and over again over these days, people bringing pilgrimages in, and to expose people on pilgrimage to the public consequences of those often privately motivated beliefs that go into getting us onto a pilgrimage. So I think there are some, and that I like that idea. I think it's great that pilgrimages to Bethlehem also hear what Palestinians, who are as vulnerable as Mary and Joseph, are saying today. So there are practical ideas.
Thanks there to Father Peter John Pearson, Parliamentary Liaison Officer for the Southern African Bishops' Conference. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.